Jeff, thanks very much indeed for talking to the History Reclaimed website podcast series today. We're looking at your article that you wrote on the website. Would you like to tell us the title of it and why you titled it such?
Yes, indeed. It's called The Myth of the Stolen Country. And I titled it for that reason because this idea of the stolen country is being bandied about on social media right now. It's very common amongst certain segments of the left, and it's becoming very widespread.
Why is it so widespread, do you think?
Yeah, well, I think it's an easy sell. So the current idea is that the majority Anglophone countries that were settled by the British, particularly the US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, were fundamentally stolen from indigenous people. On the surface, it's a very appealing take. The Europeans moved in, indigenous people were killed or forced out, and the settlers then created grand myths about how great they were. So it's an easy sell, I suppose.
And people also talk of cultural genocide.
Yes, yes. Well, cultural genocide, of course, is only part of what is claimed. I mean, now the claims for outright genocide are also very common. And this idea of cultural genocide, it's a label that one can use. It sticks. It has a lot of, how should we say, instant appeal, sort of horror appeal. But what does that actually mean in practice? That's where we have to become more nuanced.
We'll come on to you giving three examples. I know in your paper you cite the US, the UK and Canada. But before we do that in depth, you've written a lot on history in the past and you're penning a book as we speak now. Can you just tell us a little bit about your publications?
Yeah, sure. So I started out by looking at writing a few books on late medieval Spain. So it turned out to be a really interesting time and place to focus on because, of course, Spain in that time period had one foot in the Mediterranean and another in the Atlantic. So I get to watch Europe as they went from being a sort of provincial backwater only focused on Europe itself to becoming a sort of world-spanning civilization. Later on, I published a couple books and edited volumes about European expansion into the Atlantic, and so now I have a new book coming out called Not Stolen. That's going to come out with Post Hill Press next year, and that's going to be on actual European expansion into the New World. So I've sort of made the transition from Spain across the Atlantic and now into the New World.
Well, let's go now into depth, as I alluded to, on your three examples in your paper on the History Reclaimed website. First of all, should we start with the US? I mean, the Pilgrim Fathers sailed out there. They're now being criticised for having, if you like, captured indigenous Americans. What do you make of that?
Yeah, well, I mean, of course, it's complicated, and that's kind of my entire purpose in writing right now, is to debunk some of the myths that are far too easily spreading around social media, where the pilgrims were, let's say, 100% evil. Whereas there used to be maybe 100 years ago too much myth-making about the pilgrims in the United States, now there's a sense that they were actual genocidal murderers and not much else. As with almost everything in history, reality lies somewhere between these extremes. And that's what I'm hoping to prod some of my fellow historians into having the courage to say right now. For example, the current narrative now is that the Pilgrim Fathers were slave traders. But when you look at the historical record, you find perhaps one slave being held by the original pilgrims. And so, for example, that is easily overblown. And one can come up with 100 other examples if you had the time.
And that would be true, say, if people are looking at the history of colonialism and the United Kingdom and also Canada and its birth.
Yeah, precisely. Well, when you look at the French in Canada, for example, they offered full citizenship to Native Americans during the first century that they were there. Almost every commentator has pointed out that they were not racist at all. They seemed to think that Native Americans were actually the same race as Europeans. There was a story that was very common that when Native American babies were born, they were actually born white, and that may seem a little problematic today, but it shows that they truly believed that they were all one people. So this surprises almost anybody who hears about the origins of Canada, and it certainly complicates the story that you hear too often these days.
Being re-examined at the moment is, of course, the United Kingdom's history of colonialism in India and elsewhere. It's being told as if we were captors of other races and nations and took them over. Do you agree with that holistic interpretation? And are there nuances within those stories?
Well, that's just it. I think that's where we get into the critical race theory and some of the old leftist Marxist ideas that European society and originally capitalism itself could do no right. Everything it did was in some way wrong. Even if it looked right, it was actually wrong beneath the surface. And so the same thing with British colonialism, or really any colonialism by any power. One could look at the Mongols, one could look at the Turks, the Persians, and there's always been expansion throughout the globe. And some groups have been more brutal than others, but I think the British actually, as many have pointed out, rank as amongst some of the more humane colonizers in many ways. But that's a side of the story that we don't hear today.
And I know you think that democracy matters. You mentioned that later on in your paper. But first, shouldn't historians challenge how history has been told down the ages? If you're challenging myth, there is a myth of white superiority.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's absolutely what we need to do. But I think that that's what historians have been very busily doing for the last 70 or 80 years. I mean, even when I look at 100-year-old accounts of Columbus, I see plenty of criticism of Columbus in those accounts. So I think historians have been more critical than people give them credit for. And I think that really our whole profession has been so critical of Europe in the last 40 or 50 years that we've lost sight of some of the benefits that certain segments of European society did bring to the globe. For example, women's rights were much stronger in later medieval Europe already on the eve of European colonialism. The abolitionist movement was stronger in Europe earlier on. The idea that people should not be slaves, that modern idea was arguably born in late medieval Europe. Many sides to this story, which because of faddism, because of fashion, have been suppressed. And I guess I'm arguing, amongst other things, that historians need to be critical, but they need to be critical also of the fads which come to dominate our profession. And I don't think intellectuals in the last 100 years have proven to be very good at that. We've proven to be just as susceptible to fads, it seems, as anyone else, despite our claims of scientific objectivity.
We live in an age, and indeed the Prime Minister Boris Johnson has just spoken at his Conservative Party conference about this, or alluded to it. But you can't deny the English country homes, that people to whom we've erected statues in the past have gained from illicit money that, for instance, came from slavery. These homes, these wealths were based on slavery. How do we right that wrong? Because it was a wrong, wasn't it?
Sure, of course. I don't think anybody in their right mind would deny that there was plenty of wrong that was done. But we also have to look at the bigger picture in some ways. I think when you look at any country in the world, you look at any African elites for the last 300 years, there has been much profit based on suffering, as much there as anywhere else. So then you have the question of how to reckon with this, how to make reparations, whether reparations are a good thing, how to atone with the past. There's a wide spectrum of possibilities, and I guess my plea would be that we entertain these all in as reasonable fashion as possible. So I'm open to many different options of reckoning with the past, but I think that we see on social media that only one rather extreme way is now seen as acceptable by a large segment of society and many historians as well. And I think that when they become that intolerant and that insistent on a particular point of view, that's when we get into trouble.
So by, for instance, expressing the fact that we're sorry, as presidents of America and prime ministers of the United Kingdom have done in some circumstances, does that impact that atonement? Does it impact on the confidence of a nation. You talk about that, and you talk about how if we're rewriting history in this way, we're self-inflicting wounds for our own nation's future.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple different layers to that question, I think. I mean, simply apologizing, saying you're sorry, I think that's the right thing to do. I don't think anyone would have any problem with that at all. And that shouldn't make a nation feel collectively worse if it's done in a decent way, but maybe strengthen everybody's sense that right is being done. But if we go to the extreme that's going on right now, where we trash all of our national heroes to such an extent that you can't even see Thomas Jefferson as a decent guy in many ways and really a great man in many ways. If you can only see Thomas Jefferson as a sort of torturer or a slaveholder rather than a person who advanced human rights more than almost anybody else in history, if you can't see that and you undermine some of the foundations of our democratic stories, then we have potentially more of a problem, especially with the global situation where, whether we like it or not, we may have a Cold War 2.0 looming ahead of us. We have to be careful how far and how fast we go and how extreme we are when we reach for these apologies.
And so you talk about that as being the excesses of the left, and you would place yourself not on the right, but in the middle ground. And would that be true with recent history like Afghanistan?
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly I was quite the critic of George Bush's invasion of Iraq because I saw it being done on spurious pretexts. And also I thought of all the humanitarian chaos and tragedy that could occur, which in fact did occur. And on recent events, I certainly would call myself a person, you know, of the center or of the left rather than the right. I also really saying when it comes to race relations, the same sort of thing that President Obama said 10 or 15 years ago, and that used to be considered very centrist and even left-wing, which is that we should all strive to get along. We should strive to be colorblind. We should strive to not notice race that much in any negative way and aim for as much of a meritocracy as we can. That used to be considered just center-left, but now it's considered almost right-wing because it denies identity politics and critical race theory. President Obama himself has been shunned by many people on the left as being too centrist or even right-wing. And to my mind, when that happens, we've gone a little too far to the left as a society.
There is still prevalent in society today, when you look about statistics on education, on poverty, on who gets to the top in the FTSE 100, it is predominantly white men still. And there is an underclass. Would you deny that? And particularly as an economic historian, those are the kind of statistics that you look at day in, day out.
Yeah, precisely. Well, I think that being an economic historian gives me a little bit more insight into the true causes of inequality in our societies than a lot of my colleagues who are cultural historians might try to pretend. I think that they want to, because of their training, blame things like racism when an economic historian would blame things like human capital and educational opportunity and skills development. I'm very much focused on closing inequality gaps, but I recognize that it often takes a couple of generations and it often takes certain types of skills building. So I'm all for the same sort of things, again, that Obama was for, which is broadening educational opportunities for anyone who wants them or needs them. Because I see that that's really how we increase productivity and that's how we move society forward and bring everybody together. So I think that by focusing on race, you're really looking at a red herring, which tends to divide society. And it also ignores the plight, of course, of the white working class, who are still, you know, by some measures, the most numerous people in the countries we're talking about. And if we ignore the causes of poverty in general, of the true causes, the economic causes, then we're going to just create ineffectual policy for the next decade or however long this current fashion lasts.
So if we're not looking at recent and past history through the lens of racism and victimization, as is prevalent today, how should we look through it? How can we look back? What value do we place on the recent present?
Well, see, I tend to come from what's called the institutionalist school of economic history. So I believe that certain institutions, such as our democracies, are fundamental to creating the wealth and prosperity that we see in the West today. So the middle class rose in late medieval Europe. It rose in the cities where there were capitalists and bourgeois people doing their trading. And I think that if we focus more on the true roots of middle-class prosperity and the institutions and the human rights which go along with those, and yes, the capitalism that goes with it, then we're going to be much closer to creating effective policies in the world today by looking at the past through those lenses which are going to provide real and effective solutions rather than looking at chimeras and red herrings, which I would argue cause more problems than good.
And so you would say, in fact, that the balance of how we sift through history needs to be rethought through, not through something called critical race theory, but perhaps address the past by looking at a scientific, level-headed, fair approach. Is that what you're calling for?
Well, that's just it. I mean, I would say that my opponents are looking at this much more through ideology. They claim that I'm looking at it ideologically. I think we're both trying to claim the mantle of science in some way. But I would argue that right now, yes, they have a preconceived notion that society was always pivoting around race and pivoting around the oppression of one race by another. That was sort of the central dynamo of history. And, you know, when you have a hammer, everything you see is a nail. So everywhere they look, then they're going to see racial oppression. Whereas I would argue if you started with a more neutral point of view, looked more at the facts, looked more at what's actually out there in the sources, you will find a whole lot of different factors which are creating any given outcome, not just a single theoretical point of view. And to me, what's so sad is I thought we had gotten over this kind of ideological history when Marxism sort of failed in the 1980s and 90s. I thought that in the mid-20th century, historians were less advanced than they are now. I thought that we were more ideological 50 years ago and that we've somehow moved past that. But it looks like the new left, a new generation of historians, is now falling for the same traps maybe that our, you know, grandparents did or parents did half a century ago and more.
And Jeff Flynn-Paul, if we just have one more question to challenge you. If we are looking at cultural adaptation and the past and we go back and consider the role the Pilgrim Fathers played, isn't it true that you still have indigenous Indians in the United States living in encampments?
Sure. In some ways, there are many ongoing problems with natives in the United States and Canada. I think nobody will deny that. But we also have to look at the historical origins of what kind of economic background that these people were coming from and what options have been placed on the table at various times. And then we have to look at the whole history of these reservations. It's rather a complicated story. So I think that any one facile, you know, one size fits all explanation that says that Native Canadians are poor for this or that reason often overlooks that a lot of Native Canadians are, you know, half European or more than half European at this point, that many of them have had the opportunity to assimilate into Canadian culture at various times, and actually most of them have. They've moved off of reservations. That the Canadian government, for example, has been giving very generous subsidies of all sorts and including Natives in government decision-making. So indeed, there is much that needs to be done, and there are a lot of sad tragedies in the past, but we also need to see that there's been a lot of goodwill and a lot of positive work that's been done on both sides. So again, I would argue for looking at things more comprehensively and not through a single judgmental lens.
So level-headedness and fairness. And just to give a plug for your new book again, what's it called?
Yes, it's called Not Stolen. And it's going to be coming out with Post Hill Press here in 2022.
Well, Jeff Limpall, good luck with your new book, and thank you very much indeed for talking to the History Reclaimed website podcast today. I've enjoyed it.
Thanks very much, Bonnie.